You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. President Freeman Hrabowski spoke on the promotion of minority participation and performance in STEM education in the U.S. at Smith College on October 29, 2018. Hrabowski has served as president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County since 1992. He is a pioneer in innovating science and engineering education and its inclusivity. His advocacy for equality, education, and excellence for all people has its roots in a lifetime commitment to the civil rights movement.
Please join me in welcoming President Freeman Hrabowski.
Thank you very, very much. I am truly honored to be here, really honored. I have such admiration for Smith College for so many reasons. And I tell you that because as I look around the room, first of all, Kathy, the way it's situated, it's a wonderful setting. Number two, it's clear this is a community of students and faculty and staff from all kinds of backgrounds, and it is an honor to be here. I begin with a story. Everyone has a story, and we're products of those childhood experiences more than we realize, whether we are 60-something years old or 20. By the way, I'm always embarrassed by introductions because the longer the introduction, the older the person, all right? So I'm cringing the whole time saying, I hope she finishes soon, right? Somehow. But my newest book is entitled Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Movement to STEM Achievement. And this is actually HIV for my life scientists in the room. This is HIV. One of our only Howard Hughes investigator, actually, who's a biochemist. And I make the point about science, about stories, and about race, that the publishers actually wanted me to have three blacks on the cover because it's about civil rights. And yet I have a professor who is white, I have one of my Korean-American mentees, young woman, and then I have an African-American male. And we fought for months because my point was this, that when we think back over the 50 years to the civil rights movement, the goal was not just to have people of one type. It was that people of all backgrounds, that human beings would learn how to trust each other enough and develop the skills necessary to solve the problems of humankind. And so my story very quickly involves sitting in the back of a church in the middle of the week, what kid wants to be in church in the middle of the week, and I'm listening to a gentleman at the lectern who says, if the children participate in this peaceful protest, all of America will understand that even our children know the difference between right and wrong, and our kids will be able to go to better schools. We had some wonderful African-American teachers, but we didn't have the resources. And the most damning, the most damaging part of that experience was that we were always given the books that had been torn up by white kids, and then they would put brown paper bags around them and give them to the black kids. And my parents were not allowed to buy my big books because then I'd be different from other children. And so you can imagine the psychological effect of knowing we were considered less than other people. And so I immediately said, who is this guy? And they said, of course, his name was Dr. Martin King. And I went home and told my parents, I want to go, I want to march. And they said to me very quickly, absolutely not. And I said to them, you guys are hypocrites. At that time, students, you did not tell your parents they were hypocrites. Go to your room, boy, go to your room. And the next morning they came in and they did allow me to go, and it was a transformational experience for me that defines in many ways who I am, because what it taught me was that we cannot allow other people to define who we are. We were treated like animals there in the jail. It was a miserable experience, and yet in the middle of the week, Dr. King came with our parents and said, this, what you do this day will have an impact on children who've not yet been born. And we didn't understand the profundity then. As time went on, it became clear. And I tell you that story because that period in the early 60s really did transform American society in many ways. First of all, perhaps most important, when you think about it, few people know much about higher education at that period. If I were to ask this audience, what percent of Americans do you think in the mid-60s had graduated from college? What would you say? And I'm going to be doing this, by the way. I'm going to be asking you questions. You should know that. By the way, the president of Stanford, President McCartney, asked the question to presidents, how long do you think college students concentrate before they fade out in a lecture? What do you think the answer is? What'd you say? 6 minutes? So you're fading out on me right now, is that what you're saying, right? It's about 8 minutes, is what they said. So one of the things we try to do more and more, and what my campus is working on in its success in science, has to do with not simply lecturing, but much more active learning in different ways. We really redesigned a lot of courses, and I'll talk about that. But I ask you the question, what percent of Americans had graduated from college in 1963, 64, 65? I heard 25%, 15%. It was only 10%. You see, and it's very important to say that. Before we go to representation in science and underrepresentation, let's understand the larger picture. The fact is that in the mid-60s, literally 90% of Americans 25 and older had not graduated from college, and most people did not think their children of any race would go to college. Now, at that time, everything was broken down into black and white. Now we have different groups we talk about, but at that time, we literally talked about black and white census. What percent of whites had graduated from college? If 10% in general, what percent of whites? 30. Anybody else? It was only 11%. And for blacks, it was between 2 and 3%, mainly from the HBCUs, okay? Today, what percent have graduated from college? I heard 60, I heard 30. Anybody else? So the fact is that we are finally up to about a third of Americans with a college degree, okay? And when you break that down, it's about 37% white. It is about 21, 22% black. What's the fastest growing group in our country? Latinx, right? Right? It's about 15%. And for the Asian population, it's about 50%, because many people come here to grad school and their kids are here, right? But you put it together, a third. So what am I telling you, Smith College, one of the most privileged institutions in our country? This is what I'm saying. Two-thirds of American families have never had anyone graduate from a four-year institution. Now, when I say that to my friends of every race, the first thing they say is, that couldn't be true. Everybody I know has a college degree. Well, college students are around college students. Professors are around professors. And doctors are doctors, right? We're all around different people who do things similar to us. Why am I telling you that? When I talk about underrepresentation, yes, of course, I'm talking about race and ethnicity. But I'm also talking about first-generation college as a major challenge in our society, okay? And I'm talking about the need for specificity, because there are particular disciplines in STEM where women are the least well represented. And so in some cases it's gender, and we will talk about, and my campus talks a lot about LGBTQ and some of the challenges that people face from different backgrounds. And so there are many ways we can talk about underrepresentation and those with physical challenges. But I want to focus today heavily on those first generation college students, people who are women from certain disciplines, and particularly blacks and Hispanics. I had the privilege of chairing that National Academies Committee, and I want to tell you about some of what we found. It didn't surprise people that only 20% of the racial group, the blacks and Hispanics who were trying to major, began with a major in science and engineering, actually graduated with a bachelor's in science and engineering. Only 20%. What percent of whites do you think who begin with a major in science or in STEM actually graduate in STEM? What do you think? I heard 60%, 30%, anybody else? Actually, it's for whites, it's only 32%, for Asians, 41%, okay? Now, this is the part that may surprise you. The higher the SATs and the AP credits in science areas, and the more socially prestigious and academically prestigious the institution, often you find the more likely the student leaves science in the first year or two, which is always counter to what people always think. All right, now, I had the privilege of writing math questions for the SAT for years and the AB and BC calculus, right? And so, you know, those students are fairly well prepared when they've done well with FIVES, but the fact is that many do leave it within the first year or two. I've told this story to so many places, and this is one of the most important points I can make about this underrepresentation in STEM. When we talk about STEM, it's very important that we not suggest that other disciplines aren't just as important, if not more important, meaning the arts, the humanities, and the social sciences. And as I've thought about, and as my campus talks about preparing scientists, we begin with this notion that we are human beings and must understand a lot about what it means to be human first. And the notion that, so for us, even in the Bridge program, we have the sciences, but we'll have something in the social sciences and humanities to get them beginning to think about how you connect those different disciplines. I tell you about the problem of people not making it for this reason. When you look at our society, only 5% of the degrees coming out, for people age 25 with degree, will have degrees in STEM. 5% compared to 11% in Europe. And India is creating 800 additional universities right now. So there is the need for more people in particular areas of STEM. The word should be specificity. Some disciplines are able to give more opportunities than some others, but the biggest challenge in general is that Americans tend to leave STEM within the first year or two, and it's almost like a secret. Nobody wants to talk about it. I made the statement at NIH that I was talking to all the directors of the National Institutes of Health, and I said, so many students start off in pre-med and they become great lawyers. And everybody laughed, but guess what? It is really true. It really is. Because those are the two professions that people think a lot about. And the general counsel at NIH said, you just told my story. I went to the most prestigious of all. I had a perfect SAT. I got a C in chemistry. I went home and told my parents I love the humanities. And she did love the humanities, but she hadn't gotten that nurturing in the other disciplines. You get my point? And the point should be this. People who come to college to major in whatever should have the opportunity and as much of a chance as possible to reach the dream they set for themselves. There are some who want to be artists, some who want to be humanists, some who want to be scientists, some who want to be physicians. And so for my own campus, a campus that has students from about 100 countries, we talk a great deal about international and domestic diversity, both. About half of my students, 45%+, have at least one parent from another country. Whether we understand it or not, if you look at the Nobel laureates in our country throughout the 20th century, a disproportionately large percentage had parents from other countries. Those families often went to what we call the place for poor families, Harvard, or City College, or Brooklyn College, and they went on, whether in the humanities or in the sciences, and they won the Nobel Prize. What was the difference? The hunger, intensity, this notion of hard work. You know, Kathy mentioned something about the UVA. Well, the reason the UVA deal is so funny is that mine is a very nerdy campus. We take great pride in being very nerdy. I am a mathematician. I get goosebumps doing math. When I was in school in K through 12, the teacher would give us 10 problems, and I'd say, give us 10 more, teacher. And the whole class would go, shut up, Freeman. I got kicked for math all the time, all right? Some of you know what I'm talking about, right? You know, and I tell you that because the fact is that most of my students had no idea. The reason it was a big deal is that we were so bad. We were number the 16th seed, and we beat the number one seed. But what I do want applause for is the year before, we were the national cybersecurity champions. Give me a big round of applause for being that, all right? All right? Yep. And your provost knows this, that we are huge in chess. All the tables on the campus. And when you see a chess player on my campus, you bow in reverence. Did you get that? We have the A-team, all grandmasters, the Maryland champions on the C-team. And I would challenge you, one of the challenges we face in our country when thinking about gender is that we as a society do not encourage our girls to play chess. And so all of my women players are from other countries, Bangladesh, Turkey, Israel, you know. And so I encourage us to think about ways of thinking about how we encourage girls in the same way that I'm going to talk about computer science. So why is it that people are interested in our campus and what we've done? And I'm delighted that your campus some years ago talked with us about some things, and you have your AIM program now, which is wonderful. We are replicating our Myerhoff program now at several places, at Penn State, Chapel Hill, at Howard University, and some others. And this is what I want you to think about, the most important parts. I have a TED Talk that either upsets people or people agree, and it talks about what does it take for the four key points in science, for success in science. We talk about high expectations, building community, that it takes researchers to produce researchers, and then there must be a constant effort to assess what's going on. And the high expectations are not just for our students, but also for ourselves. And I've got another TED Talk talking about the culture of science. The fact is that most Americans don't think that math and science or engineering are for most people. It is a cultural challenge that we face in our society. When we work with Korean, South Korean teachers, and I usually will do some math with them and talk about our culture. And I'll ask them the question, do many of your kids like math? And they don't fully understand the question. Because it's like saying, do you like to eat? I mean, the culture is so different. Now, let me ask this question. How many in this room love to read? Right? We all love to read. It's an American. And the fact is, we all can read. My mother was an English teacher, so all of my life we were reading novels all the time and poetry. Some of you know Their Eyes Were Watching God, so Zora Neale Hurston, Ships at a Distance, have every man's reach on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing, until the watcher turns his head away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men, and my mother would say, and women, All right? And the point was there are two kinds of people in our society. And from the reading, you see those with dreams, those whose dreams are, in the words of Langston Hughes, forever deferred. Why do I tell you that? Well, reading is something that we can do. Some of us love to read, to really love to read. You love the poetry, you love the literature. But now watch this. How many of you in this room love mathematics? That's a pretty nerdy group. Congratulations. You're like my campus. This is not bad. This is about 30, 40%. Usually it's about 20%, all right? And I usually get from somebody the question, how can you put love and math in the same sentence, right? So one of the real challenges in our society as we think about underrepresentation is that it's beyond the notion of for women and people of color. In general, we do not send the message to children and to families that you can do the math and science. You don't have to even decide to become a scientist, but you can do more than you think you can do. And that's about culture change. It's about how we teach. It's about what we assume somebody can or cannot do. I will tell you that our program, the Maha program, which now has become this leading producer of African Americans in a predominantly white setting, but now actually above the HBCUs, we now have produced more blacks who've gone on to get MD PhDs than any university in the history of America. And literally. And what I want you to think about is that, I mean, since 2000, I've just put out an issue in Issues in Science and Technology. I wrote an article and I'm about to write another one. Since 2000, the number two institution in producing bachelors who are going to get PhDs, MD PhDs for blacks, is Harvard. They've produced 17, okay? And then you've got Howard and Xavier and some other places with 12 or 13. Since 2000, we've produced, to the 17 at Harvard, 42. Now, how do we do that? You do that, it's about focusing. It really is. And it's about deciding what's really important. And for us, the idea of research is critical. The two things that are very important: getting students into the research early, having a number of undergrads who publish in referee journals as second authors, sometimes as first authors. And from the beginning, my students who are here from SEO know that before the freshman year, we talk about them as PhDs. They know this, right? It's not like I may do it. No, we talk about them as PhDs, and they came back here, and I can say they get my point. It's very clear. And why is that important to think about that? When you look at NIH, thousands of scientists, for the faculty in the room, thousands of scientists at NIH. What percent of those scientists do you think are black? Take a guess. I heard 3%. It's under 1% in 2018. And for Hispanics, it's about 3%. Okay? Even the Health Disparities Institute, which is heavily on people of color, it's still under 1%. You get my point? Similarly, as you might expect, and so what do we say we must do? We must produce more students who become leaders in science. And that's from medicine to engineering. We're talking STEM areas broadly. And so our goal has been to produce these leaders who will become leading researchers on the faculties. Not just of medical schools, but other kinds of institutions. And one of the challenges I give to you, because you are one of the most privileged places, one of the most admired places in the country, you know this. I've met some of your students of color who are amazing, and I really think you have the opportunity to help some of those young people to dream about the possibility of becoming very best in class, who can maybe one day come back and be as a professor here at Harvard or Stanford or whatever. Women at Smith can do this. This is what we have set for ourselves as a goal. And you know what? Believe it or not, to be in the top 25 in the life sciences, if you were producing 2 to 3 people a year who went on and got PhDs, you'd be in the top 25 in the country. That's how small the numbers are. And my students, you get my point. It's hard to believe that in 2018 we're there. But I'm saying that people who've begun to change the culture, and you've been working on this for some years, changing the culture, the fact is that you're on your way and setting some goals and having people, women, people of color, first-generation students, you are more diverse than people realize, quite frankly, and using that diversity and the excellence, we like to use the word inclusive excellence, to have more people of both genders from all kinds of backgrounds who are excelling. The report simply said, of course we need to do more at the K-12 level. We know that, pre-K-12, and the undergrad level, grad, all the way up to the professoriate. But we said the low-hanging fruit starts with the undergrad experience. We want to work on K-12, and the Maho scholars and others and my students work with children in the city. We are very proud that we've just had great success with inner city kids, 90% free lunch, and bringing those children of black, white, and Hispanic up to literally to the state average in math and reading. Because at the heart of the matter with STEM, will be thinking skills. We know this. It is the ability to read well and think and to be able to appreciate the mathematics. And so we're working with K through 12, but the low-hanging fruit would be at this level, would be at the undergrad level, because you have students here who are better prepared than most Americans. We know that. And the question is, how do we give them the support, as you've been doing, and the mentoring to have them thinking about going on to get PhDs, MD, PhDs, or MDs, because we still have a need for physicians also. And the other part of it has to do with how to get them as involved in the research as possible. There's a book entitled The Geography of Bliss by Eric Weiner. And he says this: culture is the sea we swim in, so pervasive, so all-consuming, that we fail to notice its existence until we step out of it. I want you to think about that. The idea that as healthy as all of us may be on our campuses, we all know there's always room to be better for students, for our colleagues, and all of us. And two of the things that we have found interesting, I was delighted that one of your colleagues, I think Patricia was somewhere here, had talked about Ken Madden, my co-author, and we've written a major piece on a theory of change, social transformation theory of change. And it focuses on how we go about changing culture. And it mentions, and this is about the performance and the progress of students of color on predominantly white campuses. Keep in mind, again, that this is a 50-year experiment. Until the 80s, quite frankly, in the late 70s, most blacks were still in HBCUs. Now 80% of blacks are in predominantly white settings. And those settings are becoming more diverse anyway, with blacks and Hispanics and people from all kinds of countries. But the four or five important things: empowering setting, developing these empowering settings for minority student achievement. How do we go about building community in such a way that people appreciate the fact that they're doing this work not just for themselves, but because they can have such a major impact on so many other people? It's something that Smith has done for years for women, to be able to have women leaders who can be seen by others as the model. And I think I would challenge you to think about this notion of women of color, African Americans, Hispanics, and others who become the leaders in STEM. Because students, this is what gives me goosebumps. Every one of you clearly is somebody with solid preparation. At one of the most privileged places, you have the opportunity, each student in here of every race, to change the lives of so many other people. Think about it, because when my students get PhDs, and I've now had black women, they could be the first blacks to get PhDs in computer science from the University of Michigan, and I can just go down the line, still first and second, we're still in that line. We're still talking about first and second in some disciplines, right? And while that's sad, each one of those who's been able to do it then is able to say to thousands of others, you can do it too, okay? Because I would argue that people of color in America today are still pioneers, whether they're 18 or 50, because there's so few who have been able to move to that level. Think what I said, under 1% at NIH. When you think about sickle cell anemia, when you think about all the diseases that we have, I mean, in different cultures, the idea that we need people from those backgrounds, from the socioeconomic background, from the cultural background, but also from the scientific and from the sense of perspective to bring these people in. So I want you students to think about yourselves. And then for women in a lot of the disciplines, we have the advanced program. Faculty, you may know, the advanced program was begun at first at MIT, because they were asking the question, is it the case that women are not given a fair deal at MIT when thinking about salary, startup costs, and all the other benefits that go with it? And they found that that was a problem, a cultural problem. And because of that, NSF started a program called Advance, and the goal was to change the culture so that more women would move into leadership positions and move up the ladder in the faculty positions. And from my own campus, when we began talking about it, most of my male colleagues said, well, we have plenty of women over in science and engineering. And the women faculty came to me and said, Freeman, do for the gender issue what you've done with the race issue, and that is go and get the data. Let's look at the data. And we got the data, and what we found, unlike Smith, where you've done better, is that literally only 12% of our tenure track or tenured faculty in STEM were women. We had plenty of women there. They were grad students. They were technicians. They were lecturers, but they were not tenured professors, associate, you see? And so it was like looking in the mirror. It was very clear. And we began at that point. That advanced program grant is very significant for a number of campuses because it did transform our campus. I mean, in the first place, we asked the question, are there problems in your department? And it was as if it was kindergarten. The men were on one side and the women were on the other, okay? The guys were saying everything's fine, all right? Now, junior men, I will say, junior men got it much more so. But assistant to full professor women said, no, it's not that the guys are necessarily jerks, but the culture is one that is not supportive in so many ways. And so we went through all of that, but we used the same approach for empowering a setting. When I talked about the students empowering setting for student achievement, the same things I'm about to say for student achievement occurred for the women and faculty. It was coming up with a larger institutional change process, having multiple dimensions of organizational behavior change, and then what it means to think about what it means to have transformation of organizational culture, assessing how much progress you're making, and then what's going to help with sustainability. Because sometimes we get grants, and the grants leave, and then all of a sudden you go back to doing things the way you were. And so for us, with the advanced program, with the MAHA program, and with some others, such as the Center for Women in IT, this idea of transformation has been systematically done in such a way that we thought about how people were doing on the campus. And a part of that is listening to the voices. We are still listening to the voices of people different from the mainstream to say, what's this experience like for you? Because if you've been in experience in this environment for a long time, it's very comfortable. But for students who may be different, the real question is, what is that difference? I'll tell you something we did that was somewhat out of the box. Some of my colleagues, males, said, Freeman, I don't see why the black students are having any discomfort. We're all good people. We're all nice people, and they are. And they said, so what's the big deal if they're only 5% in the class? I said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go over to one of the HBCUs and spend the day. And they went over to Coppin State. And every one of those men came back. And these are men in their 50s, very successful. And they all said, everybody was nice, and it did feel a little strange to me. And I said, yeah, but you could leave at the end of the day. For kids of color, they're in environments, and they're getting ready for a society that is very different. And that is not to be disparaging. It is simply to say one of our challenges in the academy is for those of us in positions of power, whether it's a president, faculty members, administrators, to find ways to put ourselves in the shoes of those who are different on that campus and to hear their voices and to find ways of connecting. One of the things I say to my students, though, is I want you to get beyond your comfort zone. I want you to get to know people and see the challenges of people from different backgrounds, because as leaders, you're going to need to do that in different ways. And so from the advanced program, from the MAHA program, and then our Center for Women in IT, only in the 80s, 36% of the computer science majors in America were women. What do you think the percentage is today? You're good, you're on that one. I like that. 18%. We have cut in half. Now, I was impressed to hear today that you're graduating 30-plus women in computer science. Big deal. Give yourselves a round of applause. That's a big deal. It's very nice. It is. It really is. It really is. And the reason I bring it up is that our CWIT scholars, the Center for Women in IT, is 80% women, and we have some men who are also interested in the area, because we're saying the paucity of women in computer science is not simply a women's issue, it should be an American issue. Just as the paucity of people of color in science is not just for people of color, it is about the American democracy. It is about the future of our country, quite frankly. If we know that so many of the jobs are going to require some background in computing and technology, and we have all these people who are either not getting educated or not getting a chance to be in that world, then we have a problem as a society. Because, quite frankly, if it were not for scientists and people coming to grad school in this country, in many ways, we would be a third world infrastructure. If you look at the scientists throughout the corridor, Baltimore-Washington corridor, where there's like a lab for my campus, you look at the scientists at NIH, at NASA Goddard, at National Security, look at any of those places, and a disproportionate large number came here to grad school. Or their parents came here. You get my point? And I'd like to think of that as something that should be inspiring to all of us. What do I mean by that? That, quite frankly, when you see that intensity, then it makes you understand that the word should not be about who is smart. We make that mistake of talking about this kid is smart and that one is not. If you say these are the smart students, what are you saying to the rest of the class? Think about it. If this is the smart group, right? So the word we use on our campus is grit. Some of you have seen it with Angela Duckworth's work or Mindset with Carol Dweck's work at Stanford. But the Chesapeake Bay Retriever is our mascot, and his name is True Grit. And we say that UMBC is the house of grit. And the idea is that it is really important to think about what it means to work hard, to have resilience, to know that we fall down, but we get up. And to know, as any scientist will tell you, but anybody in life will tell you, sometimes we learn more from the failures than we do from the success. You really get to know who you are when you're having that adversity. And that's the one point I want to say to students. Students, I go around the country, and in so many places, and I've not seen one where it's not including my campus, while some students may be doing well, all of you were accustomed to excelling in high school. And you get to college, and everybody is high achieving, and it's so easy, regardless of color, for somebody, particularly in STEM, to feel ordinary. Or as if, wow, I mean, I'm not the best. And there are two or three things I would say to you. Number one, we have a t-shirt my students came up with that says, be your best self. Be your best self, okay? Number two, you don't let anybody else define who you are. Number three, dream about the possibilities. When you dream about the possibilities, you begin to realize you can keep pushing. And the more you can push, number four, always ask for help. Insist upon help. Don't ever just say, I can do this. That the people who do the best in science, and this is what Meyerhoff teaches, you work together, you work in groups, you ask for help, right? And when you don't understand, you just say, I just don't understand. I'll never forget in an algebraic topology class, the professor had gone through in grad school, and I'm the only little black kid in the class, and they're much older than I am anyway, and all white guys, and there was only one woman in the entire math department at Illinois, out of 100, and she was not tenured. But she had a way of looking at me and to say, I understand what you're going through, all right? It was tough, it was really tough. And I mean, in every class, when I first started, the professor would say, this is algebraic topology. In other words, why are you here, right? You're not supposed to be. So what I started doing for the other classes, numerical analysis, I would say, this is numerical analysis, right? To let them know, yeah, this I'm supposed to be here. But the professor had put a proof on the board, and he went from step three from a math folks in the room to about step eight. And I could go through a couple of extra steps, but I couldn't get there. And I said, how'd you get from 6 to 7? And he looked at me and he said, isn't it obvious? With that look. And the whole group, all the guys kind of smirked, right? And I wanted to say, students, sucker, if it was obvious, I wouldn't have asked the question, right? But somehow, what happened was, this is my lesson. The other guys said they understood. I went to his office. I was not going to be bothered by that. I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. I need help. Okay? And I give him that smile, and I was there constantly. So we got our midterms back, and I had an A-. And I was a nosy little kid from the South, so I'm looking at everybody else's paper, right? And all these white guys had C's. C is not succeeding in college, right? So I'm so silly, I hold up my paper. I said, I guess it was kind of obvious, huh? You get that? But I had to make myself laugh about it all, because so often we can feel as if we are not the best, or we don't understand, and I'm saying to students, just ask for the help. Just keep insisting upon the help. It makes all the difference in the world. The other point that I want you to think about as a campus, the question becomes, so you're doing so many things well. What are the challenges that you face? If it is a matter of wanting to hear the voices of people and to understand their perspective, to talk about where the common ground is. Number two, there's always a challenge on every campus of not having enough faculty of color. Let me just put that out there. 87% of the professoriate in America is still white, while we are moving towards 35-40% of the country in the next 15 years being of color. And it requires culture change for two reasons. One, to produce more people with the PhDs, MD PhDs, or whatever. But it also requires using different approaches. Now, as impressive as my campus has been in producing these minority kids, we are still in the sciences under 10% black. Our first goal was to get the first person who was of color in the department. Now, we're making more progress in the last 4 or 5 years because, as I was telling you, President, we've gone to the postdoc approach, bringing in postdocs, giving them 2 years of support, letting them work with someone else, and in many cases, it's been working out. So they move into a tenure track position. Because there are two things to say. And the professors here know this. Nobody's going to make any department take anybody. Of course not. Because if you force somebody to do it, it's not a good situation for that faculty member. But number two, it's about identifying creative ways of bringing in people who can be a part of the environment and see what it's like and giving them support. and then moving them into that position. And it's not going to be 30-40%, because you heard me say scientists at NIH only under 1%. So when you think about specialties and departments, the question is, how can the culture of this place look carefully at itself and say, what can we do to continue to diversify in some of the disciplines? But you're facing the same challenge as every other campus in our country. But I am convinced it can be done. The other thing I would say is this: how do you take those voices of people and have the difficult conversations? One of the biggest challenges in our country is, particularly because we have so many different points of view, how do we have the difficult conversations about the future of the country, about what's happening in science, about the environment of the culture on a campus? I am very proud of my students, and we've been having some protests recently, and I've always said, listen, if I can protest at 12, you can protest in college. It's okay. It's all right. But let's talk about it. It can be a positive thing, is what I'm saying. And let's learn from each other, and that's what we're doing. But I will tell you this, that my campus, my students decided, even on the political stream, we have people from all kinds of backgrounds, to have in different difficult conversations, people with different points of view. And the guiding principle that we use is this: we agree to disagree agreeably. Did you hear that? We agree to disagree agreeably. We can have these disagreements, we can have different points of view, but we want to hear those points of view so we can either criticize, critique, or whatever, and think about what we learn, even from things we don't like. And it's been interesting in science and engineering, as we've had some of these challenges and talked about it, that the most important thing I would say for any campus is to figure out how to build trust among people so you can disagree. Because in a thinking environment, when everybody is a good thinker, people will have different perspectives. They really will. I am convinced that campuses like yours have this opportunity to lead the country. And I would want to see, when we look at the numbers of women, of course, right now, you've already done it in general, but women of color. This is my challenge to you, is I would give it to Wellesley, as I know Spelman works on it, how do we have more women of color, okay, and first generation of women who become leading scientists in our country? And so I close with words from Aristotle, who said, excellence is never an accident. It is the result of high intention, sincere effort, and intelligent execution. It represents the wisest choice among many options. And then he said something that gives me goosebumps. He said, choice, not chance, determines destiny. Choice, not chance, determines destiny. And there is the ineluctable question for Smith: what do you choose? Thank you all very much.
President Freeman Hrabowski spoke at Smith College on October 29th as a part of the college's Presidential Colloquium Series. His latest book is Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Crusade to STEM. Special thanks to those who helped make this recording possible. You've been listening to College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. For New England Public Radio, I'm Anuhea Zebstad.